You may never eat lunch at your desk again after you hear this next segment. We'll be talking about eating as a total experience. Maybe every sandwich or smoothie can't reach for the stars, but why not try? Think about tweaking any and all components of a meal, from the food to the dishes to the utensils to the room. Our next guest does. He is Charles Spence, the author of Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating. Charles Spence heads the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at the University of Oxford. The work at the lab is about how our senses perceive the world around us, with an eye to develop foods and other products that satisfy the senses, from small items like cell phones to the homes we live in. Charles Spence joins us from Belgium. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So is the focus on food about getting us to eat more or just to enjoy the process more?
That's about thinking about the total experience and not just what goes in your mouth. Kind of part of the book's all about how the experience of taste and of flavor, though we think we localize it in our mouth, it's really going on in our minds, in our brains, and it involves all of the senses. And once you understand just how much role what we see and hear and feel play in our experience of food, then you might want to design things differently, either to make meals more amazing in a modernist restaurant, say, but hopefully in the long term to use some of these ideas, tricks and techniques in order to help maybe nudge us towards a more sustainable food, both for ourselves in terms of tackling the obesity crisis, but also for the planet in thinking about nudging us towards other sources of protein out there in the environment rather than the red meat.
I was not surprised to find some discussion of the consumption of insects in the book, because North America, I guess, is one of the few places in the world that does not consume insects for protein.
That's right, does not yet. Probably anyone who likes their peanut butter or jam may be consuming a few more insect parts than they realize. That's kind of the health by stealth approach. Do it gradually and just increment things.
We'll just up the legs as time goes on or something.
Yeah, up to 100 insect parts are allowable in a jar of peanut butter without it having to be declared on the label. So if that was 150 next year, who knows where we might be a decade from now.
Wow, okay, so we'll get it incremental, as you point out. So you had already summed up one of the major statements of the book. The pleasures of the table reside in the mind, not in the mouth. And the book is illustrated. The first picture is a tiny cow from a restaurant in Switzerland. What's that about?
Once you shift the kind of the center of attention from the mouth to the mind, one of the ways you start doing things differently is questioning kind of the assumptions and the way we've gone about food for a long time. And one of those is the idea of the palate cleanser, something maybe we've all experienced or heard about that they'd serve in fancy restaurants somewhere, probably an acidic sorbet, something like that, designed to, I guess, cut through something on your tongue. But I think the tongue and the mouth is in a way the least exciting part of our experience of flavor. And if flavor is really happening in the mind, when your sight and sound and touch and taste and smell come together, then what you really want is a mental palate cleanser, something that gets you into a better mood. Because we all know, I think, that if you're fighting with your partner or your kids, then food just doesn't taste good. No matter what restaurant you're going to, if you're in a bad mood, you cannot really enjoy the food. And that cow is the one intuitive solution from a chef in Switzerland called Denis Martin, from his namesake restaurant, Dennis Martin, in English, and two Michelin stars, great food, locally sourced, seasonal, organic, and everything else. But he realizes that the people who could come through his door very often were suits on account, in his description, from Nestle headquarters nearby. And just from the way they walked in, from their posture, he could tell they were not in the best mood to enjoy his food as much as he thought they should, given the effort he put in. So he puts a cow in the center stage on each and every table. This two Michelin star restaurant, no glasses, no knives and forks, just a blank canvas of the iron tablecloth and this cow. And nothing happens. Everyone arrives for that single sitting of about 30 covers in the restaurant. And then at some point, somebody will get curious to say, well, we're all here now. What is that thing sitting there in the table? They'll pick it up to see whether it's a Swiss salt and pepper shaker or something like that. And when they do so, they'll hear kind of a the moo of a cow. Because it's just a cheap €1 kind of Swiss toy, but it will make people laugh in surprise. I wasn't expecting that. And then within a moment, night after night, he has his whole restaurant full of diners with their cows in the air. You've got a chorus of moos, and most importantly, a restaurant full of laughing diners. Their mood has been elevated. That's the mental palate cleanser, and that's the moment when the first dish comes out from the kitchens.
So Charles, when you talk about the mouth is obviously not the only place that deals with a meal. Is it still the most important place, or do you find one sense that actually rides above the experiences of the taste?
So it's hard to kind of put exact percentages on these things, but certainly if I had to lose one sense, in terms of tasting, I'd lose my tongue. So I think it's the least important of them all.
Oh.
And probably if you see in the science and in the popular press, people will put numbers of something like 75 to 95% of what you taste, you really smell. And maybe we've all experienced that when we've had a head cold and our nose has been blocked. We say, food doesn't taste anymore. It tastes just as it always did. You can get sweetness, sourness, saltiness, bitterness, maybe umami. But everything else that we really enjoy in food, that our brain tricks us into thinking we can taste on our tongue, the fruity, the floral, the meaty, the citrus, the herbal, the creamy, all of that stuff is really coming from your nose instead. And hence that will be the sense that I would least like to lose.
Wow, that's amazing. So the chicken and egg question then, were you working on this field before chefs began combining disparate ingredients in new ways, or did you kind of pick up the baton from them?
Cow evolution, maybe. I started out in food, not really being interested in food, or interested in food, but not interested in researching food, should I say, and working with Unilever on the design of sort of the supermarket foods, fruit, teas, and so on. And we started doing work on the sonic chip, figuring out how we could make foods crisper, crunchier, and fresher simply by changing the sound they made when you bit into them. And separately, I think the chefs, especially those of a modernist persuasion with a molecular gastronomy who make foods look one way but taste a different way, those kind of chefs were increasingly coming up against this thing where they'd have a dish that they thought was perfect, perfectly seasoned, and they'd give it to some of their diners just to see how they responded before putting that dish on the menu, only to find people saying, "Well, I don't like it. It tastes too salty." One of the first examples from the book is actually from Heston Blumenthal, a chef from the UK, one of the world's top chefs, and his Fat Duck restaurant. And he served this pinkish red ice cream. If you just think what you would think on seeing a pinkish red ice cream, you'd imagine something like strawberry.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it's a historic recipe made of smoked salmon or frozen crab bisque ice cream. So the color is perfect, but it was just not what people expected. And it was that realization that something the chef, the world's best chef, thought was perfect, his diners did not. It was all about what was in the mind of those who were tasting. They thought it was going to be sweet and strawberry. It was actually savory, and that was not a good place to be.
All right, we'll get back to talking more about the things that we expect from food and the things we actually get from it and how surprise can be a great thing. Gastrophysics, the new science of eating, is the discussion topic. Back with the author Charles Spence in 1 minute here in The Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Charles Spence from the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at the University of Oxford, working on changing what we expect from meals and making them more lively, pleasurable experiences. Not just the food, but everything is up for negotiation. And all this is described in his book, Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Charles, how do you define gastrophysics?
So it is an unfamiliar word to most, kind of a new term that tries to capture two things. On the one hand, gastronomy, that's a gastro part, by which I mean kind of nice food, real food that you enjoy eating, talking about, look forward to eating again. And on the other hand, it's the physics, which is kind of from psychophysics, which is a part, a branch of psychology, where you kind of try and systematically study the factors that affect what people perceive, what they choose, and what they say. And it's that kind of systematic then food psychology, really, of nice food that we're trying to capture in the book and say there's a whole range of research coming out from anthropology to psychology to behavioral economics to design to the culinary arts. And when we put it all together, it feels like we're in a kind of an exciting place in terms of what the food future might hold.
So the actual sensory organs, though, I mean, and we've already sort of downgraded the importance of taste here. I mean, should we tear up the old maps of the taste buds we got in elementary school?
We most certainly should, and probably have done so decades ago. So it turns out, even I think in many textbooks, even to the present day, the suggestion is that we taste something like sweet on the tip of the tongue, bitter we taste on the back of the tongue, maybe sour on the sides of the tongue. And it turns out the reason we think that was from a mistranslation of a German textbook from a century ago. And no one's kind of quite corrected it, which is worrying in its own way. But when you look more carefully and systematically, it turns out that the taste buds distributed over the tongue, each one will most likely pick up each and every taste and they're distributed across the tongue. So really, we can taste bitter, sweet, salty, and sour on the tip of the tongue. We can taste everything at the back, too. So tear it right up. That being said, I think there's still something interesting there that we kind of feels to us sometimes, like bitterness, I get that. It feels like it's in the back of my throat. And sweetness, sometimes I feel like it's in the front of my mouth. So is the physiology of the taste buds, is that all that's going on, or are there other things to be still discovered? I'm not sure, but certainly don't accept that taste map without a little more thought and probably research.
Fair enough. You had mentioned briefly one of your partners, Heston Blumenthal, and his salmon mousse. Tell us a bit more about him. He sounds like quite the adventurer himself.
That's right. So I've been lucky enough to work with the chef and his research team in Bray, which is close to Oxford, for the last 15 years or so. And sometimes he comes up to the lab in Oxford and we sort of show him the latest research that's going on. Other times we get to go down to Bray and talk to the chefs and the kitchen staff there and get ideas for experiments ourselves. And over this collaboration over the years, things have come out, such as when we were doing work on the importance of the sound of the crunch. Heston came up, he tried a potato chip with enhanced audio, crunchier than anything he'd tasted before, and then realized how important sound was to food, how that was something that as a chef he hadn't really been taught about or thought about much, and went back, and that kind of led in the kitchens there to the evolution of the sound of the sea dish, kind of now a classic that's been on the menu for a decade, that comes to the table looking like the sea with sand and foam, sashimi, and a bit of sand underneath. But on the other hand, the waiter brings to the table a conch shell from the seashore out of which dribble some earbuds. And you put those earbuds in before you taste the food. And when you do so, you will hear the waves gently crashing on the beach. You will hear the seagulls swirling overhead. And we've done the research with the chef and his team to show that seafood really does taste better with that kind of soundscape than with modern jazz, with farmyard chickens, or with regular restaurant cutlery noises.
Uh-huh. And that's the thing, too, I want to emphasize one more time, is that everything is up for negotiation here. I mean, the cutlery, the plates, the tablecloths, I mean, everything about the atmosphere, including the food, obviously. And so just some amazing stuff you've done in the lab to misdirect people's attention when sampling new food, for example. What are some of the things, for example, you've done?
So I think that's right, that everything's up for grabs, and a lot of research has been around, you know, the ingredients, the compounds in foods and drinks and cooking preparations, but virtually no one's thought about glassware, except perhaps in the world of wine. So whenever we drink something, we always drink it from a bottle, from a can, from a cup, from a beaker, from a glass, and those receptacles influence our experience. If we hold a heavier glass or bottle in our hands, things will taste better to us. We do research to show if we just drop a little small, tiny weight in the bottom of a yogurt pot or stick one underneath a can of soft drink and give it to you, ask you to open it and taste it, you will rate that as better tasting, as probably more satiating or more filling because of the weight of the packaging, the weight of the glassware in your hand. And that's been taken through now to the restaurant setting.
Wow.
Where in the last course of the Fat Duck tasting menu in Bray with Heston Blumenthal, there's a spoon that's covered in fur that's much, much heavier than you'd imagine it would be.
Wait, the surface of the spoon that goes into your mouth is covered in fur?
Yes, or not the spoon end, but the handle end.
The handle, okay.
It's covered in fur, it's fragranced, and the whole spoon is much heavier than you think, because that, again, connotes quality, and it's also got a texture, and we've done the research to show that the texture you feel in your hand can change your experience of what's going on in your mouth.
Some of the things that are in gastrophysics are just sort of surprising about the ways in which we expect to have our attention diverted. Nobody would, as you point out, order a Patagonian toothfish off the menu necessarily, but it's known by another name then.
Yes, yes, call it Chilean sea bass, and suddenly it sounds so much more appealing, at least to those of us in the UK, in Australia, and in North America. Sales are of this sustainable monster of the deep. Gone up by over 1,200% in all three regions, simply as a function of changing the name. And I suspect for most of the foods that we serve, you know, our family in the evening or that we go out to eat, there's probably isn't that much scope to make a 1,200% improvement. But still, there's a lot of room to play there between the way we kind of casually call things or even don't give foods a name when we serve them at home, when they're given to us on an aeroplane, and how we can enhance the experience through more descriptive naming. There's even something that came out this week in the journals from the States, showing that if we're trying to get people more towards a sort of vegetable-led diet, a little bit less of the red meat, then if we think carefully about how we call the vegetables and how they're prepared, the sizzling zucchinis and you know, it's Farmer John's onions, and the more descriptive labels we give, that's a very effective way to kind of nudging people towards making different choices that might be better for them and ultimately better for the planet too.
So making choices on store shelves, I mean, is there a hierarchy, a name, price, label, whatever, that tends to be the same hierarchy for a vast range of products, or can any one of those things leap to the top depending on how catchy it is?
Yeah, I think so. Probably everything plays a role, and then the question is that you ask about how what's the relative importance of the color of the packaging versus the sound it mm-hmm. makes versus the feel in the hand. And in a way, I guess vision has been sort of prioritized, because when we're walking through the aisles of the supermarket, when we stare at the shelf, then it's always going to be vision that has precedence. We see it first, then we think about whether to pick it up. And so because we see it first, that vision, the color, will have more of a dominant role than the other senses that come in later. And that's very much the same thing as when a dish is placed down before us at the home dining table or in a restaurant. We see it first with our eyes, and our brain immediately makes a prediction. What is it going to be? Do I like it? Does it look high quality? Does it look healthy? Will it taste sweet? And all these expectations that are set by the eye, and sometimes by the orthonasal sniff as we inhale the aromas if we can, mm-hmm. They anchor the experience that comes later when we actually taste the food. We're really kind of comparing our experience to what we expected we were going to taste. And providing there's not too much difference, I think we really live in the world of our expected tastes rather than the experienced taste.
Charles Spence, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. A fascinating series of things he's doing at the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at the University of Oxford and other places in the world to look at how we can change our meals in so many ways, where everything is up for negotiation or potential change, from the food itself to the color of the wallpaper. The book is called Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to make sure we do carve out some time for the sense of smell here. And what does it mean to be anosmic to something?
Anosmia is kind of a clinical condition, which means a inability to smell. And maybe when we have a very heavy head cold, we're all kind of temporarily anosmic. Food loses its taste, as we say. Those who've been unfortunate to be in, say, a car accident and hit the front of their heads, sometimes they will come to the lab in Oxford and say, I've lost my taste. And really, they've lost their anosmic, they've lost their sense of smell. And I think every single one of us is, in fact, anosmic to something. So I myself, as I admit in the book, am anosmic to cork taint, the thing that kind of some percentage of wines seem to have gone off, lost their savor. My colleagues tell me it tastes like cardboard, wet cardboard, but to me, I can taste the perfect wine every time.
So you're the fortunate one.
yes, in this case, so I can drink the wine when everyone else has to turn up their nose. I'm made fun of, but I think it's maybe not such a deficit. Other people might be anosmic to the smell of vanilla. And there are other things like cilantro or coriander, where people aren't necessarily anosmic to it, they can't smell it, but where we divide in the taste world we have, that some percentage of people will say, I hate cilantro, it tastes really soapy to me. And others will say, no, it's a delicious herb, and I love the citrus aroma. The herbal aroma. It's the same thing, but because of the differences in our taste worlds, the genetics of our taste buds, and the things that we are anosmic to or not, it's a very different experience. I sort of think as we move forward into the world of kind of personalized nutrition, personalized health, personalized food experiences, it's going to seem strange looking back that we ever thought we should serve everybody the same food when we realize how different we really are.
Mm-hmm. It truly tastes are so different from person to person, and I don't mean that in just the mouth sense, obviously. Heston Blumenthal, I want to come back to him because as we get to the sense of smell, he serves a dish at the Fat Duck with steaming moss. What is that about?
So I think it's about the total experience. In the past, maybe those who were doing the sound and light shows over dinner and running a tropical rainstorm every 30 minutes, and there are a few places like that out there, it was all about distracting you from the food. I think something very different is going on in the present era with chefs like Heston when they start releasing aromas. And that can be not just the aromas of the food itself, but almost the moss. I'm not sure I want to taste that. But by releasing that as a scent, it may take me, it may transport me to the forest floor. It may, sometimes you may release scents that will trigger memories or moods or emotions that will then hopefully enhance the experience of the food. So another one that he's sort of famous for is the smell of the sweet shop, the kind of smell of our youths. And I can remember when I was a little child going to the store and there were sweeties everywhere around the wall. And he's created a kind of a virtual version of that smell that he releases in the restaurant before you arrive, when you're there, and to take away with you. And by doing that, it's a very particular smell. It's kind of taking you back to childhood, hopefully back to positive memories, and doing it through your nose. And this is kind of truly the world of off-the-plate dining. Grant Achatz in the States has something very similar. I think he has burning leaves, which remind him of autumnal times. And again, he's using that. And one of the cocktail makers in London, Tony Conigliaro, he's got a great one called the Rose Cocktail, which is a glass of champagne and a rose oil-infused sugar cube that he drops into the glass before you. And that releases the smell of a summer rose garden. And again, he's using this ambient scent to try and transport you somewhere good in your memory, in your past, to trigger moods and emotions. And by so doing, create a really memorable moment that hopefully enhances your experience of the food or of the drink that's been served.
Obviously, all the senses are touched on in turn in the book, and we do get back to sight, and you get into actually the whole section here on food porn, which I thought at one time referred to pretty pictures of food, but it's gone a little bit beyond that now, it sounds like.
That's right. I think there's a whole, sort of a whole science here. If one thinks back to the 1960s and 70s, then maybe that was a time when even the best of the French chefs would just kind of plonk the food on the plate as it came out from the kitchen with no thought to presentation. Then we had Nouvelle Cuisine, and now we have the rise of those blogging, social media savvy millennials and others who can't help but take pictures of the food that they eat when they go out. So in the UK, it's like 40% of diners now will take a picture of their what they're eating when they go out. And I see some chefs who say, no, I'm gonna ban this in my restaurant because my food is so precision cooked that if it's sitting there on the table while you take your pictures, it'll get cold. It won't taste as good. But give them 2 weeks, and then they'll say, okay, this is a kind of onslaught that we cannot fight against. So I think it's a whole new food future where what it looks like, the sort of pictures you can take of it, has become so much more important than they ever were. That might lead some to think only about eye appeal and how Instagrammable does this dish look.
Right.
And forget about taste, but hopefully there's some middle ground there where you can enhance the eye appeal and the taste. And when we speak to chefs, many of them will, when we ask them, we say, do you realize this dish of yours, your signature dish, like Albert Landgraf in Sao Paulo in Brazil, he's got a beautiful three onions that are kind of pink on this green tapioca spume. It's a very visually stunning dish. And you ask him, you know, this dish of yours has been shared by millions of people. How did you go about designing how he should be laid out on the plate? And he says, it's not random. I do think about it, but it's kind of intuitive. I just trial and error. But you say, given how many people have seen that dish of yours now, this is a decision that maybe you shouldn't leave to intuition, but you might want to do the experiments to make sure that your intuition matches up with what the average person who might be coming to your restaurant thinks looks great, looks most tasty, and that they might be willing to pay most for. So in his case, he's got all these onions pointing away from the diner on the plate. And you sort of think, when we do it in the lab, we find that if things point towards you, so even like a slice of pizza or a slice of cake, if it kind of points to the pointy end towards you, the diner, you will like that dish less than if it points away from you. Why so? It's bizarre. We think it's because in some of our sort of primitive brain, there's a circuit there where if you see something angular, it could be dangerous, it could be a weapon, it could hurt you. And within the briefest blink of an eye, your brain will be triggering the fear circuits. And the same thing happens when I place a piece of pizza before you with a pointy end towards you. Your brain just can't tell the difference, at least for a moment. So we have these insights from the psychology that we can then feed back to the chefs and say, okay, we'll take your dish, we'll put it on the internet, we'll allow people around the world to spin it. Say, imagine you're going to Albert's restaurant tonight. Here's his dish. Just spin the plate in a way that maybe some of us have done when we go to restaurants to eat. Sometimes the chef, the waiter or the chef will place the dish before us, and then you kind of pick up the plate and just tilt it a few degrees.
Uh-huh.
And you think that won't change the taste, but we all do it sometimes. It just makes it feel right to us. And I think that's about optimizing the eye appeal, and now we can use the power of the internet and sort of a large-scale citizen science and science museum experiments to really answer the questions of what looks best on the plate and feed these insights back to the creative chefs. We can't cook ourselves, but hopefully we can help the chefs in order to optimize the eye appeal, and so the Instagrammability and the shareability of the dishes that they serve.
I can't get my mind, Charles, off the chapter that includes a discussion of airplane food, and I wonder if that can be made fun on any level, given the limitations on surrounding and space and things like that.
I think potentially it can. There's certainly lots of challenges there that most people, when you ask them, will not have high expectations of the food that they get served on airplanes, not have good memories of it, no matter where in the plane they're sitting. And I think that's partly about the challenges of the atmosphere itself with a very dry cabin air, equivalent to being in a desert, to the lowered air pressure, equivalent to being at about 6,000 or 8,000 feet above sea level. And in our own research, the kind of the sound of the engines is something that no one's ever thought about, but that 80 to 85 decibels of background noise as the engines were, that in fact also suppresses your ability to taste. And when you see the research, you see that in fact, to get the same taste in the air as on the ground, you have to add about 20 or 30% more sugar and salt to a dish, very unhealthy for any of us. But umami, the taste you find in tomato juice, in Bloody Marys, that stands up really well in the air and actually tastes better in the air than it does on the ground. And that suddenly explains why it is that a quarter of those of us who fly end up ordering tomato juice or Bloody Mary in the air when we would never do so down on the ground.
Wow. There's just some fascinating stuff in this book. It's called Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating, and we hope to have you back at some point and talk more about it. Charles Spence is the head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at the University of Oxford. Thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Pleasure. Thank you.